The new Analyst Access program from Insider Intelligence provides clients with exclusive access to the team of thought leaders who create our retail and e-commerce research. The one-on-one sessions would be tailored to your business needs, providing a deeper understanding of the most relevant and timely research that affects your growth goals. Visit insiderintelligence.com/analyst access to find out how you can book interactive presentations on retail media networks, CPGs, and more. Hello, listeners. Today is Wednesday, April 19th. Welcome to Behind the Numbers, Reimagining Retail, an e-marketer podcast. This is the show where we talk about how retail collides with every part of our lives. I'm your host, Sarah Lebo. Today's episode topic is retail across the Canadian border. Before we jump in, we have come to an end of our contest. For the past 4 weeks, we've been running a contest where we ask questions, and whoever sends in the right answer, along with a screenshot of their podcast 5-star rating and review, wins a Reimagining Retail branded gym bag. Last week's question was, in March, an Australian startup made headlines for creating a meatball made out of the cultivated meat of what extinct animal? And the answer is a mammoth. You can't eat it, though, because scientists aren't sure how mammoth meat would interact with our contemporary human digestive tracts. As someone who's worked in multiple science museums, I obviously follow all things mammoth and mastodon closely, so this meatball story was of interest to me. Congratulations to Ashley M. for winning that gym bag. Stu from our team will be in touch with you via email on how to get that. And thank you to everyone who participated in our contest. Now let's meet today's guests. Joining me for today's episode, we have VP of Content on our retail desk, Susie David Canyon. Welcome back, Susie.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us for the first time on Reimagining Retail, it's Principal Analyst for Canada, Paul Briggs. Hey, Paul, welcome.
Thanks, Sarah. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. Let's jump into our first segment, News and Reviews, where I give the news and our guests tell me their reviews. Today's story is an April 13th one from the Wall Street Journal titled, Amazon CEO Andy Jassy commits to cost cutting and innovation in shareholder letter. Amazon and Amazon Web Services in particular faces challenges as businesses pull back on spending. Amazon's gone through two rounds of layoffs recently, and Jassy is trying to reassure shareholders in this letter. Paul, your review of this story in 60 seconds is...
Sure. Yeah. I think it's the latest example of a big tech firm kind of warning the street that leaner economic times are impacting their performance. So in the case of Amazon, they're really pointing to spending on innovative new technologies to help boost their business in the long run. And it kind of harkens back in previous recessions, like 2008, for example, when they really had a deep dive in spending to develop Amazon Web Services. And so I think using that example, I think, is a way for Amazon to kind of let the street know that they are, in this lean time economically, investing in new technologies that may come up with something that is akin to a new business line like Amazon Web Services. So I think that's part of what the message was to the street.
Okay. And Susie, your review of this story in 60 seconds is?
Literally the same thing. I would say just the small addition in that some parts of their business, Amazon's business, is not doing very well. And those are the usually more margin draining businesses that are capital intensive, whether it's people or systems in terms of like inventory or, you know, goods, i.e. retail. And so it's not a surprise that they're trying to figure out how to bolster some of the tech first that is once developed a lot cheaper and higher margins than some of the other once were core businesses. And then I would just say, like, it's obvious for this particular audience, he needs to be super peppy and like, don't worry, we've got this, right? So it's not a surprise that this is how he's going with that.
Makes sense. Okay, now it's time for our next segment, Retail Me This, Retail Me That, where we discuss an interesting retail topic. Today's topic is retail in Canada. Paul's joining from Canada, and Susie is joining us in a Canada t-shirt.
Yay!
I'm joining us just from New York City, not in a Canada t-shirt. But today's topic is retail in Canada. In the last 6 months, Lowe's, Nordstrom, and Bed Bath & Beyond have all announced that they are leaving Canada. On the flip side, some U.S. brands like Walmart and The Home Depot have done exceptionally well in Canada recently. So let's jump in with an extremely broad question. What makes a U.S. brand succeed in Canada?
Yeah, I can dive right on that one for sure. There, just for some context, some of the largest mass merchants in Canada are American businesses with Canadian-owned whole subsidiaries. So a key for those successes is investing in the market, investing in local knowledge, understanding the regulations that apply to the retail sector in Canada, and investing in local talent. And I think that's what a few of those examples that you mentioned, including Walmart, The Home Depot, Costco is another one, that have a massive impact on mass merchant retail in Canada. So a key drawback for some of the failures is trying to apply some of the strategies that worked in the US and apply them to Canada. I think it's a different market and it needs to be invested in adequately in order to succeed with the Canadian consumer.
And I would say, right, you can't just come into a new market and not do research. So we're talking about a completely different country, not another state of the US, but even for another state, right? You need to understand who the consumer is, what the competitive landscape is like. Is there room for your brand? Can you build a community? You know, all the usual things, but now you have to add extra sort of knowledge, which like Paul is saying, it's the people on the ground. So the French language and what does that look like? The different laws, the different ways of thinking about pricing, the different ways that Canadian consumers express loyalty, coupon usage. You know, I mean, you have to think about all these things in order to be successful.
Yeah, and packaging as well, Susie. So obviously, two national languages in Canada requires packaging to be bilingual. And I think that's something that it's an obvious, you know, item that retailers should, that it's easy to understand, but even that has been a pitfall for some retailers.
And like, I would also throw in location is important, right? So these are companies, retail brands that are in more or less strip mall sort of style, right? They're not like a department store in a mall. Canada doesn't have a ton of malls and it certainly doesn't have a ton of amazing malls. The population density is such that there are key areas where one could potentially be. So Nordstrom didn't, you know, it didn't necessarily stand a chance. I know we're going to talk about that after, but Nordstrom had a tough time because it's in a mall and there aren't that many successful malls. Whereas if you think about Walmart, Costco, they're all in these like strip mall sort of centers, which also has a different foot traffic, different usage pattern, could have helped. You know, even Best Buy is more of a strip mall style retailer than a Nordstrom.
Yeah, I was just going to bring up Best Buy, which succeeded in Canada by acquiring an existing company, right?
Yeah, that we're going back a few years here where Best Buy entered the Canadian market, you know, 15 plus years ago, and they acquired Future Shop, which was a local retailer. And that was their big strategy to come into the market, was to acquire a company that was essentially the same as Best Buy, but in Canada, and then eventually over time, rebranded those Future Shops into Best Buys. And according to some of the surveys that we see, especially in consumer electronics, Best Buy is a leader today, you know, all these years later. So that's one key strategy. Another example is Lowe's. Lowe's entered the Canadian market, you know, 2007, 2008 timeframe. They acquired a company called Rona, based out of Quebec, who was in that big box home improvement space. They acquired Rona in 2016, but Lowe's just announced back in the fall that they're exiting the market. And they're taking a pretty big haircut on that deal. They acquired Rona for $2.5 billion back in 2016, and they sold their Canadian business unit in total for like $0.4 billion just to Sycamore Partners back in November. So a massive devaluation on that transaction for sure.
So what made Home Depot succeed where Lowe's failed?
I think it goes back to what we mentioned earlier about investment in the market. Understanding the market very well. Home Depot was the first of that ilk to come in before Lowe's and some of the others. So I think Home Depot had a real niche play in Canada, including courting contract businesses or contractors as part of their consumer base. So that was a big effective strategy for them as well.
It's interesting though, right? Because there is no rinse and repeat, just like I was saying, how malls, you know, if you're in a strip mall, you'll be more successful. If you think about Lowe's, they're also in a strip mall. Best Buy is in a strip mall. I mean, their Bed Bath & Beyond's not doing well, although that's not a surprise since it's not doing well here in the US either. So it is interesting, I find, that Home Depot is fine because we have a really, really strong Canadian do-it-yourself sort of hardware store called Canadian Tire. So it is, you know, again, it's like you have to start with research and understand what's happening in the market and who are the consumers and is there room for a second one. So clearly, there was room for another giant home hardware type store.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, Susie. It's pretty competitive on a national level for do-it-yourself kind of hardware stuff. And Canadian Tire, as you mentioned, is a long-standing, iconic brand in Canada. There's more to Canadian Tire than tires, as the famous ad campaign from probably the 80s.
I remember they're probably the first one with a true loyalty program.
That's right. Canadian Tire Money. So for those that you don't know, there was little fake dollar bills in various various amounts that I remember as a kid, I had a bunch of Canadian Tire Money in a jar.
Yes.
Physical dollar bills you had to hold on to?
Like Monopoly style. Yeah, but we're talking about like, I don't want to bring
a punch card to the coffee shop.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I don't want to insinuate how old Paul is, but we're talking about like 25 years ago, maybe more, because I was a kid too. And we had them way before anybody else was talking about this. And then, you know, they realized nobody wants, like you said, nobody wants to carry their Canadian Tire money. So they had these bins where you could donate the money for causes. So I think, you know, it was just a different way of thinking about a feel-good sort of halo effect about a brand that is truly loved in Canada, I would say.
Very Canadian.
And yet Home Depot is doing well, right? So there is no one size fits all, I guess, is the answer to why some fail and some don't.
I mean, you're talking about sort of like what you've said, like a second one coming into the market. Is that's kind of what happened with Target, right? Which also sort of fizzled out in Canada. Like Walmart was succeeding in Canada.
Yeah, the Target example is – so this Nordstrom news that came out a few weeks ago or a month ago, a lot of people are comparing the Nordstrom announcement to what happened with Target. So Target came in about 10 years ago to Canada with a lot of fanfare, but the consumer experience was not what it was in the U.S. So a lot of Canadians crossed the border into the U.S. states to shop at Target, and they loved it. They thought it was a better Walmart. But the experience in Canada was not the same. They had supply chain issues and merchandising issues that they could not overcome. And they basically packed up shop. And that was a high profile exit of the market. And a lot of the recent news, including Nordstrom's, including Lowe's, Bed Bath & Beyond, people are comparing it to that Target example.
And it's interesting because Nordstrom has been in Canada for a lot longer. Like Target came and left, right? They like cut their losses and moved on very quickly. But Nordstrom has been in Canada for longer and they really tried to give it their all. You know, we have a lot of cool Canadian brands. I don't know if they weren't carrying enough Canadian brands or if the price disparity between buying Canadian that were carried at the Nordstrom's in Canada was different from the pricing wise. You know, it wasn't worth your while. You were better off cross-border shopping. I also don't know if Target definitely had issues scaling their operations. One of the issues, quote unquote issues with Canada is that everybody is pretty much around the US border and then there are like bits and pieces of people everywhere else. So it becomes very expensive to do that last mile delivery. Clearly more important for a Target that is like everyday goods versus a Nordstrom. But I think, you know, companies come in, give it their best shot without truly understanding how to scale properly, and then either keep sinking money into the operations, perhaps like Nordstrom did, or just cut their losses and move on like Target.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, and another factor, I think, regarding Nordstrom, just to close out the Nordstrom topic, I think they were up against a really entrenched competitor in Holt Renfrew. Yeah. In a lot of the same markets, Toronto, Vancouver, et cetera, and Holt Renfrew, there's a lot of loyalty to that brand in Canada. So I think that was another factor.
Yeah. I think that's really interesting also, the like cross-border aspect, because what you both have been saying is that Canada's not another U.S. state as much as people in the U.S. might think of it as like North Dakota. But even though like it's a completely different country, you still have like most Canadian consumers living driving distance from the U.S. and being familiar with the U.S. shopping experience, who still have that competition.
Right. And I mean, like the stat is something like 38 million Canadians, which is around the size of California. And then about 90% of Canadians live within 150 miles of the US border. It's not as easy. Again, when I was growing up, it was super easy to go back and forth. And we were talking about this before. You could go for the day and come home. Not quite as easy, but still so easy. Plus, let's not forget, you can do cross-border shopping online now too. You don't need to physically go to the store. So I think over the years, people just have a different expectation and experience with brands, regardless of where their headquarters are. And those expectations remain when you have a physical location in your neighborhood.
I think that's the perfect transition for flipping this question on its head. We've talked about how US brands have fared in Canada. Now let's talk about how Canadian brands have fared in the US. So in the first half, we did Retail Me This, Retail Me That. Now we're going to do Retail Me That, Retail Me This. I asked about how US brands that succeeded in Canada. What are some Canadian brands that have done well in the US?
I think the shining example here is Lululemon. So Lululemon, based out of Vancouver. And just, it's kind of funny because there's something in the water in Vancouver, because a lot of what we're going to talk about in this segment is Vancouver centric. So just an FYI. But Lululemon opened their first shop in Vancouver back early 2000s. By 2005, they had, you know, three stores in the US, but they had four times as many in Canada. And now they have more than 300 locations, Lululemon retail locations in the US. And it's a category that, you know, that athleisure category of apparel. I think Lululemon was at the very forefront of tapping into it and is a big reason why it had appeal in the US and internationally.
I think there are lots of brands coming out of Vancouver. You're right. Like Aritzia is another one. I think as a proud Canadian, I would say there are many, many, many brands that are here in America that we don't even realize are Canadian. And we can sort of talk through a lot of them. Some of them super iconic, like Aldo, Canada Goose, obviously. There's Oak and Fort, which is like a brand new brand in Canada that's like popping up all over the US right now. I think there is, you know, some sort of cachet sometimes for having, because just like Americans think Canadians are another state, they also kind of think of them as international, right? And they're like, Canada is really strong when it comes to fashion and fashion sense. And so I think there's also that appeal as to why some of these companies make it big here. Although there are some, sadly, that don't make it big, that try and then don't stick around in the US.
I wanted to jump on what Susie was mentioning about Aritzia, because Aritzia, Bloomberg, so after their most recent quarterly announcement, Bloomberg in the US said it's the hottest fashion brand in the US is Aritzia. And this is a brand out of Vancouver that's been around since the 80s in Canada, but they're now really investing smartly in building up their retail brick and mortar footprint across the US and are doing extremely well. And I think a big part of the story with Aritzia is Gen Z, which we call Gen Z in Canada. They tag their clothing everyday luxury. And I think that it comes at a price point that appeals to younger consumers. So Gen Z is a big target for Aritzia. And of course, they're tapping into some influencers on TikTok and Instagram that are really highlighting some of their new fashion lines as well. So Aritzia is an interesting story because of that tie to the Gen Z demographic.
Everyday luxury is a really interesting thing for you to call out, because that's sort of what Lululemon is also, is affordable luxury. So maybe a similar story, slightly different generation. Susie, did you have something to add?
I think there is potentially a little bit of currency exchange favor for Canadian companies too, making it here in the US. And also, you know, better understanding what markets are hot in terms of trends, like whether it's fashion, athleisure, affordable luxuries, so that they can make it big. Because if you think about it, a little bit is luck too. You know, why did Lululemon make it big, but maybe Roots didn't make it quite as big, a super iconic brand in Canada that does apparently have 14 stores in the US, but still not quite as big as Lululemon, right? Or why is Canada Goose huge, but then we have a lot of other, Sorel is not quite as big, but also a Canadian company. So I think some of it is a little bit luck too, or maybe it's first mover advantage.
I guess like the overarching question is like, why do you think that Canadian brands tend to have more luck in the US than US brands tend to have in Canada?
That's a good one. I think I would say probably, you know, there's luck all around. Just like how there are so many entrepreneurs who start a new business idea and only a very, very small percentage make it, even though some of them have the exact same business idea, right? So some of it is about the right talent. Some of it is about enough capital. Some of it is about entering the market at the right time. Sometimes you can be too early to get to market. You know, if Lululemon had come into the market right now, would it have been okay? Maybe not, because they would have zero brand recognition and everybody is tightening their budgets, right? So I think it's a little bit of everything on both ends, whether you're going into Canada or whether you're coming into the US.
Yeah. And the examples that we talked about, Lululemon, Aritzia, they were kind of on the leading edge of trends in fashion. So I think they had sort of a first mover advantage, I think, that allowed them to gain traction in the US and internationally. So I think if you want to look at potential next success stories, I think that's where you would look. Are they bringing something to the market that isn't matched elsewhere? And if they are they doing it with a smart strategy of brick and mortar and in e-commerce, have a real omni-channel strategy to make it happen?
And to be honest, I find that in America, there are so many stores. I mean, I know obviously that means that there's a lot of competition, but in Canada, there is not, you know, like every brand, like Nordstrom had 20 stores between all the different banners. In Canada, we're not overstored by any stretch of the imagination. In New York, there are like 10 gaps around, you know, within a very small radius. So I think that also helps, right? Because Canadian brands can come into the US. Obviously, it's a gigantic country with a much higher population, and you can drop stores in lots of different places, especially if you use your data, right? So if you're doing cross-border selling and you know where you're shipping packages to and you drop a store there, you are more likely to be successful using that data piece and insight than an American brand who's going and littering Canada with a bunch of stores. And it's just not the way we operate over there.
I want to talk more about speculation about like what stores would succeed in the US. First, I want to circle back to something you said, Susie, which is Canadian brands that don't necessarily succeed in the US. Who did you have in mind?
I mean, I think it depends on how we measure success. If we measure success as coming, trying, and leaving, I actually don't have too many in mind. I think probably the one we always talk about, I feel like they're all successful in a different way. If they go in and try a store and it doesn't work, like Aldo used to have a lot of stores and now they're sold in a department store. I think different brands come in and try and tweak their business model to try and be successful. There are other companies that have come and gone. I mean, we talked about Tim Hortons, which we can definitely talk about, but Le Chateau is one that came and then fizzled out of the US before it fizzled out of Canada. So yeah, there are some, but it's definitely harder to find.
Yeah, and regarding Tim Hortons, I think the success metric is a bit unfair because in Canada, Tim Hortons is ubiquitous. It's on every street corner. It's part of the Canadian identity for a lot of people. So to achieve that level of success in the US is just not feasible. There's too much competition. It's a different market entirely. So Tim Hortons has aggressively gone into the US and border states back as far back as the 1980s and the 90s. Didn't really have a lot of success.
Yeah.
Now the news is that they're opening in the southern US, like Florida and Texas, to appeal to snowbirds, which are Canadians that are retired and head down for 6 months of the year. So that's the newest strategy from Tim Hortons, is to open those in those states in the south to try to tap into that market.
Okay. My last question here, I want you both to speculate. What is a Canadian brand you think would succeed in the US if it chose to fly south? Paul, you go first.
Great. You know what? I was really tempted to go with Dollarama. Dollarama is a discount store chain. It dominates discount retail in Canada with like a 50% share. It's just amazing. So I don't know if they would want to take the leap into the US, but so I'm not going to say Dollarama. But the company that I want to highlight is a company called Herschel Supply. They do backpacks and accessories for outdoors. It's also based in Vancouver. They had their first retail shop there and now have a CEO who formerly from the North Face, from Arc'teryx, that is looking at expansion to the US. They launched their first retail outlet in New York City in November. I love their stuff personally, and I think they have a real opportunity to make a lot of success in the US.
Yeah, I know Herschel. I didn't even know they were a Canadian brand because they definitely do a lot of like e-commerce in the US already. So, I mean, there's reason to think they'd succeed here for sure. The backpacks are definitely recognizable.
I picked a company that I didn't actually realize was Canadian, which is Mountain Co-op. I don't know if you remember that store, Paul. Like, we used to have those backpacks all the time for school. It is an iconic, I didn't realize, Canadian brand, especially in the 90s, 80s and 90s, really. And it's all about outdoor. It is, you know, high quality, well-priced, activewear, basically, and equipment. And since that is a hot market in the US, I feel like it's just a matter of time that they come here. However, when asked the question, they are just saying, we currently don't have any locations outside of Canada, but you can always shop online, which is a different way of cross-border shopping. So I don't know, maybe they'll be the next ones here.
Interesting that you both picked outdoor goods companies. That is all we have time for today. So thank you for joining me today, Susie.
Thanks for having me. Super fun.
And thank you, Paul.
Thanks, Sarah. This was fun.
And thanks to all of our Canadian friends and listeners, colleagues near and far. Please give us a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Instagram at behindthenumbers_podcast. Thank you to listeners and to Victoria, who edits the podcast. We'll be back next Wednesday with another episode of Reimagining Retail, an e-marketer podcast. And tomorrow, join Marcus for another episode of the Behind the Numbers Daily.